The Tom Woods Show, episode 1738.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, just in from a trip to Ohio, and happy to see some interesting developments here in my state of Florida. I looked through my mail, and I saw a postcard from a theater group not too far from where I live, maybe an hour, advertising a play they have running for a couple of weeks in October, and advertising their upcoming season. I thought, this has to be a mistake, right? This is, let me guess, this is going to be some virtual play I have to watch over Zoom or something? What is this? And I went to the website, and sure enough, it's a play, and they're selling tickets. Now, they're going to be socially distancing you in the audience, but they say that by the time you get to their production of Beauty and the Beast, and I don't know where that falls in their season, they expect the theater to be fully occupied. So they don't say, you're never getting your life back, or we're never again going to play to full audiences. No, we're intending that to happen this very season, and we're starting that process right away by just beginning our fall season. I couldn't believe it. Then the Dr. Phillips Center, which is a performing arts center in Orlando, has announced a couple of events taking place there. And then at the same time, what else was it? There's the Orlando Philharmonic announced an event. Now, it's just an event with a soloist, a violin player. But this is something, right? I mean, this is, I'm sure you can't get this in a lot of places in the United States. So that's been quite a pleasant surprise because I love all these things. I love the Dr. Phillips Center. I love musical performances. I love theater. And little by little, it's actually coming back. It's not, well, we're never going to do these things again. I can't believe that somehow somebody was running rehearsals for something all this time. Amazing to me. Maybe actors in the South. I don't know if Florida counts as the South because of so many transplanted Northerners like me. But it's just amazing they found the actors who wouldn't pretend to be horrified at the idea of rehearsing when, in fact, we all know that in their hearts, it's killing them not to be rehearsing for anything. And probably in their brains, they even know that it's silly and no, you're not going to die at a rehearsal, for heaven's sake. So anyway, I've got some interesting guests coming up this week. But in particular, I have, let's just say, a Harvard Medical School professor who is an infectious disease expert who thinks that the approach that's been taken in the U.S. is entirely wrong, involving lockdowns, could not possibly be more opposed to that. He has a much more sensible strategy, and I'm going to really be able to pick his brain a little bit later in the week. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking to, if all goes well, a fellow who is known online as the meme policeman. Maybe you've seen him. You know, you see all these crazy memes coming from the other side, and they make ridiculous claims, and yet they spread like wildfire. Like it's a one or two sentence thing on a photograph, and it's whatever. It's spreading nonsense about anything from the minimum wage to anything you can imagine, and they spread around and people just absorb them. Well, he's the meme policeman. He exists to refute them, to show where the oversimplification is and whatever. So we're going to talk to him about some recent ones, but also about how he's established himself with tens of thousands of followers just doing this important work. So we got some fun guests coming up for sure, but I want to talk to you about a few mostly virus-related things today. But let me first start with a little something about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because she died while I was out of town. And of course, you know, she was a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, it's interesting to see that how many people who disagreed with her nevertheless said at least something nice, at least in the sense of offering condolences when she died. And just contrast that to what happened when Scalia died. It was not exactly the same thing. And then Obama said he wasn't going to attend Scalia's funeral. I mean, it's just this kind of thing that it's just an interesting double standard that, I don't know, I feel like folks on our side are more gracious and more willing to treat people like human beings. And the other side just refuses to do that because they are so convinced of their own righteousness, they can't even concede the humanity of people on the other side. But I'm hearing from people who loved Ruth Bader Ginsburg that what made her so great was that she fought for what she believed in. But of course, that is precisely what makes you a bad Supreme Court justice. fighting for what you believe in has nothing, literally nothing, to do with being a Supreme Court justice. You know, look, I don't have any fetish for the Founding Fathers or the Constitution, but I can say this. They did not write the Constitution and talk about a judicial branch for the purpose of having Ruth Bader Ginsburg fight for what she believes in. It is to interpret the Constitution. Maybe you want the Constitution to say something different. Maybe you want it to mandate all kinds of crazy things on states and individuals, but you're going to have to amend it first, because that's how the system works. But the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs of the world are people who thought, well, I would like to see this and that in the world, so I'm just going to rule that way. But all right, then somebody you don't like who looks at the world completely differently will then get into power and say, well, I'd like to see this kind of society, so I'm going to impose this kind of society on the world. Now, no, that is not what makes you a good Supreme Court justice. So the very fact that they're saying, I love her because she fought for what she believed in, shows that they are not even entitled to an opinion. And I saw some footage of a little rioting in New York City. Hasn't New York been through enough between everything that's happened and Cuomo and de Blasio? Now they've got rioting going on because of the death of Ginsburg. And I just couldn't get over this. I mean, really, even if Ginsburg gets replaced by a strict constructionist of the Constitution, which we don't really have any of left anymore, but even if she were, all that means is that you'd just have local self-government. So, you know, the different states would have different policies on a lot of things, the way, you know, the country was supposed to be. You can see that all through the Constitution in many ways, that's what it was supposed to be. Diversity. Remember that? You know how people love diversity? Well, this would be a diverse country, and people with different beliefs would live differently. That's the worst outcome that you could have. That's as bad as it could get. That is the worst boogeyman scenario that could possibly occur if you had another Scalia. That is the worst possible outcome. I don't think Ginsburg supporters realize this, because I don't think most of them, frankly, are entitled to an opinion, or B, really understand anything at all about what's at stake. I think they think that social justice is at stake if the Supreme Court doesn't do such and such. Supreme Court is just interpreting the Constitution and trying to see if particular laws are in conformity with it or not. And that's it. And you can change the Constitution if you want. The Supreme Court has nothing to say about that. If you'd like to change the Constitution to allow for certain things, go ahead. Knock yourself out. Go ahead. So you might have to amend the Constitution now in order to do things that you can't get passed at the ballot box. If you want to force them on the country, you're going to have to amend the Constitution. That's the big, terrible thing that everybody is rioting about and crying in the streets about. They are so anti-local self-government that they're going to go and riot. We don't want local self-government. We want a 5-4 majority of lawyers making the big decisions in this country. That seems like a very strange principle to riot over, if you ask me. So I'll try and get somebody on this week, and we'll talk about what this all means, the vacancy left by Ginsburg and the rush to fill it, and who might fill it, and all that stuff. We'll try and talk about that sometime this week. So now moving on to this, the stuff I wanted to say about the virus. There's an interesting article that I'll link to on the show notes page. That'll be tomwoods.com/1738 from, of all places, Jacobin Magazine. Now, if that magazine rings a bell to you, that could be because, for one thing, Gene Epstein and I did an episode where we took apart the editor of Jacobin. We didn't take apart the editor of Jacobin. I mean, took apart his book on making the case for socialism. But also Gene debated this fellow, Bhaskar Sunkara, at the Soho Forum. And by Oxford-style results, he was declared the winner. Now, Bhaskar is a strange fellow. He really did not want to debate, didn't want to debate his book. And then after the thing was over, he wouldn't stay for the reception. I mean, again, it's just so typical. It's absolutely what I would expect. I mean, if you were to ask me, which side of that debate do you think would hang around for the reception? I know exactly which one, and I know exactly which one will be surly and unprofessional and nasty. Now, listen, Gene got very animated in that debate, I'll grant you. But that's how Gene is. I mean, afterward, he's the kindest guy in the world, and he wants nothing but to learn from you and to give you a chance to learn from him. I mean, this is what he loves. And this guy was like, you know, okay, my watch says it's over, and I get my money, I'm getting out of here. So very, very disappointing, but not at all unpredictable, not at all, precisely what you would predict. Well, anyway, Jacobin has a very, very encouraging piece. It's actually an interview with two professors from Harvard Medical School, one of whom I will be talking to as well, about the pandemic response. And they are saying that clearly we cannot think about more lockdowns or continuing the current restrictions because they're having a disproportionate impact on, guess who? The most vulnerable people and the working class. And so they're thinking in terms of left-wing categories, of course, but they're correct. Obviously, the most vulnerable people are going to be harmed by lockdowns. They have fewer options available to them, and they're closer to destitution at any given time than people who are wealthier are. And so they go through in this interview all the kinds of arguments that have been made in defense of lockdowns, and they just will not admit any merit to any of it. So the two people are Catherine Yee and Martin Kulldorff. I'm just going to give you a couple of, or let's say several different passages here that I want to share with you, just to give you a sense of what's going on. Now, I don't know. Now, Yee obviously is at least a social democrat, but I think probably well beyond that, I think is a pretty serious leftist. Kulldorff, I think is probably on the left, but is really, really trying not to politicize this. And I think that's quite admirable because it is a tragedy that this has turned into left versus right. There's no reason for that. Absolutely no reason that it had to be this way. So one of the questions is, do we need to wait for a vaccine? Should we just stay at least partially locked down until a vaccine is developed? And these are going to be Dr. Yee I'm going to be sharing. She says, I don't think it's wise or warranted to keep society locked down until vaccines become available. There are 9 vaccines in large-scale efficacy trials as of mid-September 2020, and my guess is that at least one will be approved for use in the United States by sometime in 2021. But this is not certain to happen. Furthermore, neither the effectiveness nor the duration of immunity from any of these vaccines is known as yet. There are additional uncertainties about how many vaccines can be manufactured, distributed, kept at the requisite temperatures, and administered in a short amount of time after authorization or licensure, and whether a sizable portion of the population will refuse vaccination. So we can hope, but we certainly can't count on a vaccine saving us either as individuals or as a population in the short term. Regarding policy, early in the U.S. epidemic, based in part on the experiences of Italy and Spain, the urgency of, quote, flattening the epidemiologic curve was emphasized. It was indeed crucial to take steps to ensure that hospitals and healthcare resources not be overwhelmed, as they very nearly were in parts of New York City, for instance. But I've been struck by how this emphasis on keeping the numbers down at all costs has not evolved with time. There is a kind of simplistic goal of keeping people from getting infected, period. Now, this may seem like a worthy goal, but with a highly contagious respiratory virus, to which most of the world's population is probably still not immune, people are going to get infected. The virus will spread, quickly or less so, until herd immunity is reached. Instead of a medically oriented approach that focuses on the individual patient and seeks, unrealistically, to prevent new infections across the board, we need a public health-oriented approach that focuses on the population and seeks to use patterns or epidemiologic features of the disease to minimize the number of cases of severe disease and death over the long run as herd immunity builds up. Now, incidentally, if you mention the concept of herd immunity, you're viewed as a monster or crazy or whatever. And so Dr. Kulldorff says, somehow herd immunity has become a toxic phrase, which is strange since it is a scientifically proven phenomenon just like gravity. Except for the occasional skier, people do not argue for or against gravity. Whatever strategy we use for COVID-19, we will eventually reach herd immunity, either with a vaccine, through natural infections, or a combination of the two. Now back to the other doctor. Herd immunity is something that simply happens with infectious diseases. When enough people have been infected or vaccinated and become immune, the pathogen is sufficiently blocked by the immune people that it can no longer spread in the population. Although it doesn't necessarily go extinct due to newly susceptible people entering the population and importations of the pathogen from other human populations. Folks, let me take just a brief minute to tell you about the way I solve a major problem that we all have. Because we're all intellectuals, we have a pile of books we want to read, we have no idea how we're ever going to get through all of them. And the answer is Blinkist. It's unique and powerful. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser. It gives you the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories. Blinkist condenses them down into blinks, which you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. And I like Blinkist because after that 15-minute blink, I know whether or not the full-length audiobook is really a good use of my time. I use Blinkist when I'm driving around in the car, which would otherwise be dead time, and I'm absorbing book after book while I drive. I've listened to these blinks, and I highly recommend you check them out. Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker and The Doomsday Machine by Daniel Ellsberg. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership and up to 65% off audiobooks, yours to keep forever. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Well, then the conversation turns to Sweden, and by an interesting coincidence, Dr. Kohldorf is actually from Sweden, and they ask him, should the United States act more like Sweden? And he says that Sweden basically is pursuing the kind of strategy that he would recommend, which is an age-targeted strategy. That is, obviously, the young are at essentially zero risk, and so there's no reason for them not to live their lives, and you put provisions in place to protect older people. And he says that except for the failure to protect nursing home residents in Stockholm, the country has done well without a lockdown. He says that daycare centers and schools were never closed for children between ages 1 and 15. There were zero virus-related deaths as a result, a handful of hospitalizations, and teachers appear to have suffered no additional risk over and above what people in other professions suffered. At this point, mortality from the virus is close to zero in Sweden. And he says this kind of age-targeted approach is what they've followed in Florida and South Dakota. And it's the opposite of what was followed in New York and Massachusetts. So in New York and Massachusetts, he says you had low-risk children prevented from going to school, low-risk young professionals protecting themselves working from home, but older working-class people had to go to work to feed their families, and elderly infected patients were sent to nursing homes where they infected other high-risk people. That's the opposite of the strategy we should be following. Then the conversation turns to postponed health procedures because of emphasis on COVID. Now, this is something you occasionally read in the mainstream, but is not very often acknowledged by people who want to promote panic about the virus, because they're afraid that if we try to balance our considerations here and realize that if we devote all our resources to fighting one battle, we're leaving immense wreckage everywhere else. That might make us rethink the whole thing. They just tend to stay away from this stuff, but not in this interview. So Dr. Yi says, there are various kinds of preventative care, including routine immunizations that have been delayed and might continue to be delayed because of this epidemic. It may take some years to see the actual effects of this deferred preventative care in terms of diseases that would otherwise have been prevented or caught at earlier stages, but there will surely be an impact. And then Dr. Kohldorf, like Dr. Yi, I am very concerned about the collateral damage of lockdowns. In public health policy, we cannot just consider the present consequences of one single disease. We must think more broadly, considering all short and long-term health outcomes. Doesn't that sound very, very similar to economics in one lesson? Right? Maybe this is epidemiology in one lesson, or infectious disease in one lesson, or public health policy in one lesson. That's really what it is. You can't just sit there and look at one set of numbers for one thing and think, well, I've done my job. Yeah, okay, maybe. And this is a big maybe, you might be able to bring those numbers down slightly. But obviously, the picture we want to look at is not just that set of numbers, but all the numbers in the long run, not one set of numbers in the immediate run. We need the whole society in the long run. So likewise, it's exactly the thesis that Henry Hazlitt put forth in Economics in One Lesson. You don't evaluate an economic policy on the basis of what its outcome is for a particular earmarked group in the short run. Because yeah, obviously you can have an economic policy that initially benefits a targeted earmarked group in the immediate run. Duh, you'd be an idiot if you couldn't devise such a policy. But the real question is, what is the overall effect on everybody in the long run? That's what we need to be looking at. And that's, of course, what we need to look at with the virus. And, you know, ask any of these scientists who are, you know, pointing their fingers at you for being a terrible person, can I please see the modeling you've been doing relating to the non-COVID deaths and suffering caused by your COVID policy? Can I see those models? And of course, they'll turn around and run the other way because none of them are modeling that, not one of them. And then they go on to say what should be obvious to everybody. Millions of working class people have lost their jobs and find it impossible to find new ones in the current shuttered economy. It is remarkable that the media pays so little attention to the extreme economic hardship being endured by millions of people who were already struggling to make ends meet before the pandemic. Not only have they ignored this, they've mocked and ridiculed these people. And anybody who complains just wants to leave his house to go get a haircut. That was what we heard. They just want to go get a haircut. I mean, that's some kind of, I mean, I almost feel like no normal person could look at it that way. This is some kind of coordinated effort it's some kind of psyop or something. I never talk this way, never. You've heard me for almost 2,000 episodes now. I never talk this way. But that is abnormal to look at what's being done to people and saying if they're complaining, they just want to go out and get a haircut. This must be some kind of like, maybe there was a literal memo that went out and said, here's how we're going to treat these people. Instead of having any empathy whatsoever, we're going to ridicule them and make them look as frivolous and ridiculous as possible. I mean, really, people don't spontaneously talk like that. They just don't. And yet it was so widespread. Everybody was talking this way. Very, very strange. I mean, I don't care how much of an insane leftist you are. On some level, you're still a human being. And I just cannot imagine people spontaneously talking like this about fellow human beings who are suffering. And instead of trying to at least understand them, and instead of saying, look, I realize that it's terrible the sacrifices we're asking you to make, and we're really sorry about the outcomes right now, but unfortunately, all the alternatives are worse. Well, why is that so hard to say? Why could not one of them say that? Not one. Why could they not say that simple thing? It all had to be, these people have to be shamed and ridiculed. That's not normal. There just must have been an editorial line set down in major newspaper offices. There just had to be. Because that you're suppressing a natural human instinct there for people to speak and act that way about suffering people. I like what Dr. Yi, by the way, says about the following. She says, the moralistic finger wagging must also stop. It makes no sense to try to shame or worse, expel from college young people who go to parties or bars. She says, my colleague Julia Marcus has written persuasively about how counterproductive this attitude is. Infectious diseases will spread, and exposures in young, healthy people contribute to the herd immunity that will ultimately benefit all. Now, isn't that interesting that a very left-wing professor at Harvard Medical School says that? Whereas right now, the only people saying that right now are on right-wing Twitter. What's still left of right-wing Twitter? That's where you can hear this. Everywhere else, it's, oh, you can't say that. We have to minimize the number of cases. No, we don't. No, and that's actually not good. And then there was a time when I guess Trump said it was good news that the people getting the cases were younger people. And of course, well, the media says, here's what Trump said is good news. Look at all these cases. Yeah, but see, he's thinking of this, actually, because some sensible person explained this to him, and that's what he was thinking about. And then she concludes with, progressives should be advocating for a sustainable, communitarian approach that is informed by the knowledge that the virus will spread until herd immunity is achieved, acknowledges the need for stringent protections of the vulnerable in order to minimize deaths, and recognizes the harm caused by crude, across-the-board lockdowns and their disproportionate impact on workers and people of color. All right, so it turns out there are left-wing voices against the lockdowns, but man, are they quiet. Or man, are they suppressed and kept out of the mainstream channels. But they're there. And I know that Jacobin doesn't want to work with me, I'm sure, but I'm glad to promote them when they're talking about stopping this. You know, then they talk about Medicare for all, and then, you know, what do you expect? But at least they're sane on this issue. At least they're good on this, which, by the way, is more than I can say for some of the people in neocon land who were, you know, ordering people who were doing the whole stay at home, save lives thing. These people are pretty darn good compared to them. Now, one final note, this was encouraging. It's discouraging that it's only one person, but Van Morrison, I'm not a particular fan of Van Morrison, but he's okay. He, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, made a statement about the need to reopen performance venues without social distancing. He says, you can't profitably run these venues while social distancing. We got to reopen them at full capacity for people who want to do it, who people who think that living involves actually living. We were told that his fans all shamed him and whatever. I'm sure he got plenty of support, both open and secret, for that. Because I'm sure that your host here is not the only one who's tired of all this. Well, now he's written three protest songs against the lockdowns, and he's going to be staggering their release, beginning this week with one of them, and then the other two sometime in October of 2020. And so far, it looks pretty darn good. The lyrics that have leaked out look pretty good. Now, nobody can report on this impartially, because it's all the reports are meant to demonize him. But he's calling on his fellow artists to join with him in fighting the lockdowns, in fighting the restrictions. He's, it's ridiculous that it's just me and Andrew Lloyd Webber who are saying that enough's enough, it's time to live like human beings again. So that's very, very interesting. And as I say, I'm not really a fan of his. You know, when Roger Waters performed the Wall concert at the site of the Berlin Wall, the former Berlin Wall at that time, 1990, I remember Van Morrison sang, what did he sing? Comfortably Numb, actually. And I liked him then, but I like him a heck of a lot more now. So anyway, I'm going to link to a story about that. So let's write down Van Morrison. And we'll write down, what was the other thing I said I'd link to? Oh, that interview in Jacobin magazine. Yeah, you might enjoy reading that. There's a lot of really good information in that. So all this stuff will be at tomwoods.com/1738. All right, so if you like and appreciate what I'm doing, and you would like and appreciate being among people who aren't, at this stage even, still not going to call you a grandma killer. There are still people who are going to call you names for living your life. But if you'd rather be with people who know what they're talking about and are interesting and aren't just robots repeating establishment talking points, then you will enjoy being a member of the Tom Woods Show elite, as well as all the many other benefits. And the benefits I give you for supporting the Tom Woods Show are so ridiculous at this point, it's almost going to make you laugh. You should go check them out over at supportinglisteners.com, because not only do you get great bonuses and membership in an amazing community, but you also warm the old man's heart here. And can you really put a price tag on that? So check that out, supportinglisteners.com. Meme policeman tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.